She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, and I hope you didn't miss that intro. We don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and I can promise you once again, we are going to give you a great deal to think about today. Thanks for joining us. This show is made possible through a partnership with the University of Arizona, and we thank them for their support of Mrs. Green's World, creating a global community of people who care about the planet. And I am very excited about our guest today, or I wouldn't have this wonderful guest. It's like I say that and I think, I don't have guests that I'm not excited about. My in-studio guest is Dr. Joaquin Reese. He's from the University of Arizona. He is the Vice President of Innovation and Strategy, the Executive Dean for the College of Letters, Arts, and Science, the Dean of the College of Science, and a Professor of Geosciences. So let's just hold on and be ready to learn some very important things going on at this great university. And I, of course, have to add that it is my alma mater. So welcome, Joaquin. I'm glad you took the time out of your very busy schedule to be a part of Mrs. Green's World.
It's an honor to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
And we're going to have a lot of fun. So our first bit of business is to give a shout out to one of our national sponsors who is truly committed to sustainability and sustainable practices at the highest level, Ecobella. They are the very kind of retailer who is committed to fair trade, to using organic, to non-toxic skincare products. And you know what, folks? I say this week after week, we are one planet, and all of those things really matters, especially the retail part of it when you're spending your money. Their products are natural, sustainably sourced, and most importantly, there are things that nourish your skin and they work. And as a woman, we want to spend money on products that work, make us feel good, make us smell good, and not be filled with toxic chemicals. It's a company you can trust. Please check them out just once. Tell me what you think. I think you'll use them forever. Their website is ecobella2c's.com. And even if you don't make Ecobella your choice, please join me in supporting companies like them for our own health and the health of the planet. And another quick announcement, we have just wrapped up our fourth annual Arizona's Greenest Workplace Challenge, the most successful one to date. And if you're curious about the winner and who was the People's Choice Award, please visit our website at MrsGreensWorld.com. Thank you to our sponsors, our prize sponsors, and to all of you who participated, especially those who voted for the People's Choice Award. Okay. Let's get started, and I'm going to say it again. Our featured guest is Dr. Joaquin Reese from the University of Arizona, VP of Innovation and Strategy, Executive Dean, College of Letters, Arts, and Science, Dean of the College of Science, and a Professor of Geosciences. And I really don't ever want to sound cliche on this show, but I certainly do want to ask you, do you just think sleep is for sissies? Because I don't know how you have time to sleep when I look at all you're doing. So welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, let's set the framework for our national listeners about some of the areas over which you have ultimate responsibility. I mean, you are the Dean of the College of Science. That's in Tucson. That's really probably your highest profile. But you have your fingers in a lot of pies. So can you tell us a little bit about a day in the life of Joaquin Reese?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, the College of Science, which is an enormous operation that spans from the space sciences to the neuroscience and cognitive science, is something that keeps me thinking all the time about where the country is going with respect to those disciplines. The rest of the time, I spend worrying about the biosphere, which is also under my direction, a wonderful instrument that has had a funny life, but that nevertheless is truly an extraordinary facility for studying the environment. And finally, I am very preoccupied these days with trying to understand where the ecosystem of universities are going and how to maintain a university like the University of Arizona at the top of the game in a country that is rapidly changing its view of higher education. So I worry about, for example, as the country has stopped funding research the way that it did in the past, how do we become or continue to be relevant? How do we continue to be strong in the creation of knowledge, which is what universities in the end are all about, and the dissemination of that knowledge? So our mission is sort of changing all over the place. In the creation of knowledge, the requirement of funding, and in the dissemination of knowledge, of course, the technological improvements that we have, that we have to worry about. It's really exciting, actually, but I think that in the next 5 years, there's going to be such a difference in the way that universities operate that there are going to be some that will remain in the status quo and I think will therefore not be as relevant as those that can innovate.
So when you say you worry about that and the whole mindset of our country around higher education, what are some of the things that you have come up in that brain of yours that are a solution to some of those things? Because you're right, to be on the competitive edge and stay on the top of our game, it's getting tougher and tougher when you factor in that mindset, especially. So what's, when you worry about it, some of the things that come up, what are some of the key considerations that people have to listen to if their paradigm is shifting away from how important we are as world leaders to value higher education?
Right. So if you look at universities today, ours, for example, which is a state-aided university, what they call Research One University, that means it's very large. It's funded partly by the state. Maybe 20% of our budget is the state, maybe a little less. And where most of the budget comes from federal grants and contracts and tuition. And the whole game of tuition is one that we have to worry about because the way we educate students will be different. And also the type of disciplines that we want to highlight may be changing. I think there has to be a place in universities that is going to advance more and more master's degrees, professional master's degrees, something that in the sciences has not been actually done very well, except for maybe chemistry and hydrology and geology. But the biologies have never really done that. The physics for sure has never done that, and mathematics hasn't done that very well. But I think that there's now a marketplace for students with a master's degree in those disciplines that is very important. So that's one big area of concern. The other area of concern is as federal grants and contracts from NIH and NSF not only maybe become less than they used to be, it's also going to be more directed. So as an example of that, I am convinced that in the future there's going to be more and more requests for proposals from the federal agencies that are going to be mission-oriented, the same way NASA does it. You know, NASA, there's a big proposal, request for a proposal to go to Mars or something of the
right,
sort.
Right.
NIH and NSF really haven't done that much. And the way that those agencies have operated is that people write proposals, faculty members write proposals. And they can be very large or they can be small. But it's driven by faculty members and their interest. And I'm convinced that more and more there are going to be requests for proposals, both from NIH and NSF, that are also mission-oriented. NIH will be the structure of the brain. There will be big conglomerates that will be focused on that. And therefore, the ecosystems of universities have to do that. We actually have then to be able to create the same kinds of teams that have been created in places like planetary sciences to write proposals for NASA. So there has to be a big change in the way that universities actually organize themselves so that we can be competitive in that way. The other interesting and important thing is that is industry. If you look at industry in the U.S. and in other places, a lot of industry doesn't do any research or have been getting out of research. Pharma is one of them. It's not that they don't do research, but right. The amount of money that they put into it has become less. And I can go down the list. Other companies still invest a lot in research, but in the end, the way that they actually get IP is by acquiring other companies. So they're not very successful actually at research in those industry. A great example of success, in other words, those that do get it, is right. like the Googles and whatnot. But 3M, Xerox, all these companies have for many years acquired IP by buying companies and not necessarily by what comes out of their research labs. So there has to be a connection there between universities, industry, and I think the federal government, which we just have some of it now, but that I think is going to be the way of the future. And those universities that get it right, that partner with industry in very strategic ways, and I don't mean just writing just some faculty member with a contract.
Right, and you don't mean just a contribution. You mean a true partnership.
A true partnership.
With a shared vision.
Then I think that's where we're all going. So as you can imagine, thinking about this, thinking about who your true partners are going to be, thinking about what those partnerships are all about is a big deal. Changing the ecosystem of the university so that we're prepared for these big mission-oriented research projects is a big deal. And the third one is international partners. And many countries, Australia is a great example, have already gotten this. But I think that we have about 5 years to develop true strategic international partnerships with whomever we think is our strategic partner. And after 5 years, those that didn't get into that game will be irrelevant in the international field. So there's a lot to do.
It's going to be a huge game changer as far as you're concerned. Well, there's two things that come to mind when you're talking about it. One is absolutely what I worry about is kids even prepared to go to the university. Mm-hmm. And the U of A, I think, has done a lot to get them ready. But when you read about how our report card on a global scale for scientists, math, kids even going into that, is that one of the things you worry about at night and help address? Because getting them there is one thing, which is huge. Keeping them there is another. But having them be prepared once they get there, I think it's a huge national challenge.
I'll not be wearing my hat as dean of the College of Science. That clearly is a very important thing. At the University of Arizona, we have students that really are ill-prepared. It's a state university, and most state universities have that issue because the entrance to the university is one that's required by a constitution of the state or whatever.
Right.
And then we have students that basically could have gone anywhere, and we're thankful that they chose to be at the U of A. And the challenge is, how do you educate everybody so that those that have been admitted to the University of Arizona, it hasn't been a false promise, and that you do your very best to try to make everybody successful. And we have a gazillion programs to try to help.
And I don't think that's an under-exaggeration.
Yes.
I think you have, if you want to succeed at the U of A, somebody's there to offer support.
Right. And what I've been focusing in particular to try to help students at the university and that our president, President Hart, we have a new president at the University of Arizona that actually believes in this vision as well, is the engagement of the undergraduate students since day one in research, in community engagement, in whatever scholarship that they belong to. But a way that they actually get engaged at the university in a very personal way with a smaller group of people, and that they don't become invisible within the university. So in science, it's easy. It's easy conceptually. Students should all be engaged in research. Somehow or another, since day one, they should be involved in a laboratory doing research, and I don't mean washing dishes,
right,
but really research.
Yes.
If they do that, what you're doing is you're bringing a student from the anonymity of 40,000 students to a small community of people in that lab that includes a professor, a couple of postdocs, PhD students, and whatnot. And that then allows a student, you sort of, it's a smaller community, which means that all of a sudden you're like in the liberal arts kind of community where people take care of you because you're part of that community. And in addition to that, you become, I think, your thinking process is different because you're actually engaged in research. You get involved with a professor that then is going to write letters of you, which are not anonymous letters. I keep telling students that come to the U of A, it's better if a faculty member says, yeah, this person was in my lab and they were great or they're whatever, and not that the professor says, well, this student was in my class and it was a top 10 percentile.
Right, you know, right. Where there's absolutely no meaning. It's like a form letter.
Right. So undergraduate engagement, I think, is absolutely critical.
And it is so research-based about the smaller communities, and even with classroom size, it's in starting at the very beginning of education.
Right.
So the other piece of that makes me, I want to know what goes on in that brain of yours, is we are the University of Arizona, huge force in here, other than just being Wildcat fans. Mm-hmm. The other piece is Davis Monthan. Mm-hmm. And from my 6 years of being Mrs. Green, when you talk about R&D, we have had so many gifts brought about to the sustainability of the planet because of the research of the military. So mm-hmm. What about meaningful partnerships with them and how you value that? Because they're right here mm-hmm. and they're doing unbelievable things.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a research component, and that typically is through the Department of Defense.
Right.
Which I think you're absolutely right. There's been an enormous amount of progress that's been brought to this country and the world because of the research that's been done through defense. The other are novel ways of helping educate people in defense. So in the case of Davis Monthan, I'll tell you a really nice one. And this is where you can see, if you really sit down and look at each other as partners, you think about things differently. Davis Monthan has the largest number of weathermen of all of the forces. And the way that it works is that the folks that are the weathermen for Davis Monthan and for the rest of the Air Force, they can take courses in the Air Force that gives them the equivalent of a degree from a community college. So the Air Force has their own
own curriculum and their certification.
Right. But what happens is that if in the end you don't get a bachelor's degree while you're in the Air Force, you're not going to be able to progress within the Air Force. And if you leave the Air Force, you're also in a bad spot. So we came up with a partnership with them so that the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the U of A created a whole series of sets of courses on the web, in addition to helping make sure that what the Air Force was actually, the curriculum of the Air Force was completely accepted by the University of Arizona for the 2 years that they took it. So now all the weathermen can actually get a degree, a U of A degree, regardless of whether they're in Qatar or they're anywhere else in the world, as long as they take what the Air Force has for them, and then they take our courses online. They'll get a bachelor's degree, which will allow them to either stay in the Air Force and have advancement or leave the Air Force and have opportunities for a job.
So it's another really good example of how we're utilizing it. And one of the things I say, and I've said it to you personally, is the whole integration of thought and practice, because it's like the silos. There's universities, so many of them, they're silos, and I have no idea what's going on the other side of campus. And is that part of your paradigm shift of thinking, where there has to be more integration, and you're part of hopefully moving that charge, leading that charge for all of the things that you have a part of.
Right. So partnership. So in the same way, partnerships with industry should be real partnerships. I can envision, for example, hiring faculty members that are joint appointments between industry and the U of A. And in the in a place like Tucson, which is a small community with not too many opportunities, it would help even for hiring talent. Because people that come to industry would be interested in being connected with the U of A, and people coming to the U of A as faculty members would be interested in the opportunities they would have if they were also if they were also researchers at Ventana or at Sanofi.
No kidding. And have some type of, you know, the whole, there's academia, but then there's really what it's like out to be in the cold business world and make that happen. And when we come back, we have to take a break, but I think it's a perfect segue to talk about, at least in the first segment coming back, the whole tech launch.
Okay.
Because to me, there is, we've had some great guests on that talk about the area of great ideas, creativity, innovation, and then there's the next stage, which is where so many great ideas die.
Right.
I mean, it's literally a dead zone. And how do we do that? Because I think, as an entrepreneur, that marriage of innovation, technology, great ideas, and helping those scientists that really just know how to look down and create good ideas get married to the business partnerships and the paradigm of how do we bring it to market? How do we make it happen for all those things? Okay, well, you are listening to Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. I'm glad that we have the signal because I would go right on and we'd talk through the break. I am interviewing Dr. Joaquin Ries, who is the Dean of the College of Science among his many responsibilities. Please stay here with me. We'll be right back.
Can you predict the future? The reality is we can't, but we can be ready for it. Funded by the National Science Foundation, researchers at the University of Arizona are working on a $3 million project to study the monsoon and learn about our changing desert weather, climate, and ecology. Such knowledge will help guide us to a more sustainable future, not just for our desert, but for the world. Now that's thinking ahead. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
It's got advanced technology. It's got major breakthroughs in technology everywhere you look. It's the 2013 Honda Accord. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green, and I want to share with you that after nearly 40 years of heritage, this is the most stunning Accord ever. The highly respected Automotive Magazine raves that the 2013 Honda Accord offers unparalleled talent of goodness. Please visit Chapman Honda at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson to check it out and see for yourself.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill. But I have a bigger reason to give. My brother, Jim. When Jim was just 6 weeks old, he had a stroke. He had to rewire his brain to do most things we all take for granted. Thanks to Goodwill, Jim has a job and a sense of purpose. You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill is the best thing that ever happened to Jim. Please donate today.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I think that for those of you that listen, our guests always give us incredibly important things to think about. And it makes me want to get up every day and help be a part of the global community of people who care about the planet. I am thrilled to be interviewing Dr. Joaquin Ries, who is from the University of Arizona. He's the president of Innovation and Strategy, the Executive Dean, College of Letters, Arts and Sciences, the Dean of the College of Science, and a professor of geosciences. So again, Joaquin, thank you for being here. And I think a perfect segue for that and me wearing my businesswoman hat is that there are so many great ideas that literally die on the vine. You have scientists. So many times it's the same thing with artists. They are the artist and they are the wonderful creator. But in terms of marketing them, you know, Diana Medeiros is a person that I can think of that she was in marketing first and then she became an artist and then she knew how to market the heck out of everything she did. But that's a hybrid that's rare. Mm-hmm. So the tech launch was a solution to that. And can you just talk a little bit about that, how you take them from the brain, you know, the I thought of this too, getting it to market is the hardest part once the discovery has been made.
Right. Well, I think the person you really should invite here is Dave Allen, of course, who runs Tech Launch Arizona. But
I read a lot about him when I was doing research for this, and it's like note to self.
He's just wonderful. But the issue that universities have is complicated, right? You're absolutely right that there's a tremendous amount of new knowledge being generated, and you get as you would imagine, you get two kinds of end members. You get those faculty who think that their invention is going to change the world, but that in fact it's not, for either because it's early or late or just not a business opportunity at the moment. And there are those that don't even know that they have a gem that really could change the world, and they don't know how to move with it or care actually about that. So the challenges of universities, there's some, of course, that have been doing this very successfully for many years. MIT comes to mind. But others in which the history of trying to move technology from the university out does not have a long or successful history. So two things have to happen, and I can just speak at what is going on at the University of Arizona. And you've already mentioned another challenge, which is really outside of the University of Arizona, and that's the funding and so on. That's a different challenge. I can say a few things, but I don't think I can say too much about it. But within the universities, what you need to do is three things, I think, minimally. One is educate faculty about the opportunities that may exist. Educate faculty about how to protect their intellectual property, because that's a very important thing. Many times, faculty publish, and they don't realize that the minute that they've published in Science or Nature, which is what's in their DNA, that's the end of their idea, at least as a personal property.
Right.
So there has to be a fair amount of education so that faculty recognize how they should protect their ideas. There has to be also education about, at the university as a whole, about the importance of actually getting your ideas transferred to the world and not just publishing.
Right, bringing it to market.
So there has to be a bit of a cultural change. I think at the U of A, we really haven't had a long history that if you're doing applied science, you're sort of second rate, thank God. But you have to codify that so that promotion and tenure and all these personnel issues that traditionally in universities rest on how much you publish, also take into account the opportunities of bringing your technologies to the outside, or at least getting them patented.
Right.
So patents
right.
should count. So we've done all that. The second thing you have to do is educate faculty about what it takes to protect your IP, what it takes after you protect your property to either license it or try to go and get a business going or whatever. Those are educational components that didn't exist before. So if I had some idea that I thought I had some, let's assume that I already was interested in some technology that I thought I had that could be worth something. Where do you go in the university to get it all done?
Right.
So you have to publicize the fact that there is a structure within the university that's there to help you out. And that's what really Tech Launches Arizona is all about. And then you have to fund that entity, in this case Tech Launch Arizona, so that it can actually have enough money, not only for all these educational things that you have to do, for the creation of the culture that you want to have, but also then to patent, to create the licenses, do all of this. And that's where we are right now. Dave Allen, I think, arrived only about a year ago. And I think he's done a marvelous job so that faculty know that if they go to Tech Launch Arizona with an idea, that idea is going to be taken seriously. And that a yay or a nay, as a function of whether it's in the eyes of those that that understand this, is a useful thing to move forward or not, or to protect it or not, because all those are all those things cost money. You know, whatever decision you make is either going to cost you money if you decide to go with the technology or not. All of that is happening very, very quickly.
But you're right. You bring up another point about your job. The responsibility is not just getting the idea to market. It's literally getting the word to the people that work there that this is a possibility.
Right.
So you have the whole internal marketing strategy that has to be developed. So some kid who's 24 years old working on something knows that, oh, I think I have this great idea. Where can I go? So it's a whole thing. When you talked earlier in the segment about the ecosystem of the university changing in the next 5 years to be one of the emerging universities in the United States or globally, where does this fit in? Do you think this is a key component that had to be in place in terms of the whole tech launch and knowing that that's rock solid by the time we get there?
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you remember, I mentioned that I think that a challenge that we have to overcome is how do we actually have strategic partnerships with industry? And you certainly can't have very strategic partnership with industry if you don't have your ducks in a row internally.
Right.
About IP and also a cadre of faculty that are really fired up to do that.
And I just think about the daunting part of the competition. I mean, to me, you can look at some of the companies out there, and there are millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Right.
And there are a lot of you saying, look at us and have a meaningful strategic partnership. So that's an unbelievable part of it, too.
Right.
How big a role, and I did read some report cards on this, and I think it's a good report card, I wouldn't have brought it up. Because of the tech park and the tech launch, there's actually a report card on the website of angel funding and venture capital projects and projects that have been funded. And it looks good. I mean, it looks really good. Do you know how you measure up? You know, I mean, there is MIT, but in terms of the University of Arizona, are we starting to be seen as an emerging leader in a place that then attracts the people that, oh, if I go there, I know that there's going to be a partnership to help get my ideas out there, or it's a culturally rich setting for me to go to for what I want to accomplish?
Right. I don't actually know of measurements, but I can tell you that certain parts of the University of Arizona have been extraordinarily successful at these kinds of endeavors. Optical sciences is clearly right there.
Yes, they are.
And there's a segment of our medical system that also has been successfully creating a lot of IP. I mean, Ventana Medical came out of the University of Arizona. Selectide, which is now part of Sanofi, came out of the University of Arizona. Those are pretty big deals.
And it's a perfect example because they came back here.
Right.
And they built here, and they really, you talk about sustainability and closing the loop.
Right.
I mean.
So there's a lot of, there's a lot of evidence that we can do it. There's also a culture at the university that is quite entrepreneurial. So that always helps. In fact, we've invented a lot of disciplines. I mean, just inventing the discipline tells you that we are sort of inventive. So I think we're poised to do all kinds of things. And what we just needed was the right structures that would allow us to move forward in a more systematic way so that those, you don't want to be at the forefront of something and also be challenged by all kinds of walls that are created by your own institution. So you have to get rid of those. So that if you're an amateur at trying to get a company done or whatever, you don't have even your own institution get in the way.
Right, right, right.
And that's where we are now, I think.
It's exciting. And of course, I get myopic because I'm here and I interview people all the time and I am part of the university community. So I think everything going on is just great. And then you look out at the world and I interview other guests and it's like, yeah, let's stay competitive. Let's stay on it because it's more than just being a wildcat. I mean, this is wildcat country and it's kind of funny, but it's kind of not because that is a tie to the university. That's a common thread with everybody. It crosses all mindsets. A perfect segue to the lecture series, which I cannot believe it is it its eighth year? It started in 2006. So so it will be 2014. It's like, it's, oh my gosh. And I remember when it happened, when it first started. And I do believe that it's fair to say it was a brainchild of yours. So talk about the lecture series. And I want to tie it back to how does that fit into your whole view? I'm very intrigued by this, our five-year plan, which I agree with you. There are going to be a lot of businesses and universities that are going to kind of die on their sword or just going to go away in this emerging entrepreneurial, rapidly changing market. So talk about the lecture series and how that came about.
Well, that came about from a deep belief or agreement with Jefferson's view that in order to have a working democracy, not only do you have to have economic development, but you have to have an educated population. And I think universities should not only think of their own students, but the responsibility that we have to the community as a whole to keep them educated so that we can basically vote with some kind of reasonable degree of knowledge.
Right.
So when we started this was a time when you may remember that in Pennsylvania there was a big debate about intelligent design and putting intelligent design in the curriculum. And I woke up one morning and I just said, well, you know, I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to actually give my opinion about the intelligent design or not. But I think although I could, but I won't at the moment.
We could do another show.
Yeah, we can do a show about that. But what was true was that I thought that the population at large should try to really understand what we understand about evolution. So that they could, if they had to vote, I mean, that was in Pennsylvania, but if they had to vote here, for example, in a similar thing, they would at least understand what we know as scientists about evolution, including terminology like theories versus hypotheses, you know, this kind of stuff.
Science.
That makes sense.
Science.
Right. So what the idea was to create a series of lectures, and six or five, that were thematic. So the first one was about evolution. So that when people from the community came, if they were fortunate to take all of the six lectures, they would really know about as much as we know of that theme. Maybe not deeply, but they would understand it all. And I thought maybe 250 people would show up to the lecture, but the first lecture that the room was filled up.
And people got turned away.
They got turned away, and we kept moving to bigger and bigger venues, and we ended up in Centennial Hall, which, as you know, we filled it up, and it has 2,500 seats or something like that.
And they're free.
And they're free. So at that point, I said, whoa, clearly there's a real interest and thirst for these kinds of events.
Good information.
Good information here in Tucson. I think it says a world about our community, right? I think I'm not quite sure we could actually fill Centennial Hall anywhere we had these lecture series, but in Tucson we're blessed to have a community that's interested about this. So then we decided to continue the thing. The next year was about global climate change. So there were six lectures that basically addressed global climate change, what we understand about global climate change. The next, I don't remember exactly how it went, but we had one about mind and brain. We had one about cosmology. And the trick about all of those lecture series that we've created is that, one, they're still filled with mystery. So that when you're finished listening to all these lectures, all these professors, you understand how little we actually understand about and how complicated and how complex the whole thing is. So it gives everybody a pause about how much we really know and how much there is to know. And when you walk out of there, like I said, after the six lectures, if it's about cosmology, you know about as much as an astronomer. Okay, not with the mathematics and the details.
Right, right, right.
But you get the whole concept. And if you went to mind and brain, when you walked out of the six lectures, you understood enough about what we understand about the structure of the brain and about cognition. So it's been incredibly exciting. And an added thing that has come out of that, because when we first started this, we were really looking outward to the community of Tucson and how we could best educate these folks. And we worked really hard so that the faculties that were the folks that were giving the lectures, they knew that they had to shoot their the lecture topic or what they were talking about so that the people in the room should understand about 90% of it. If they understand 100% of it,
important.
They're
don't
bored.
Speak science. Right. You have to speak to the people.
Right.
So that, yes, so they don't get it.
They have to get about 90% of it. If it's more than that, that means that you've talked down to them. And if it's less than that, you'll lose them in the first 10 minutes. So we have this little group where all these very, very recognized faculty members have to give their lecture before they go out. And, you know, it's the word police, and that's been incredibly successful. But the final thing that I wanted to just mention very briefly is that in addition to what the good that we do to the community, I've been able to put, I'll talk a little bit more about how this is constructed, but I put these faculty members together to create the lecture series. So it's created interdisciplinary groups within the university that
keep going. Have a life of their own.
Right.
I mean, that's another critical piece of that integration that I see all over everything that you're doing. And it will be a huge part of the survival and hopefully the thriving in the University of Arizona. Okay, everybody, I hope that you're as enthralled as I am. It's really, we're getting some great information about what's going on inside the University of Arizona. My guest is Dr. Joaquin Rees from the University of Arizona. Please stay here with me. You are listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And of course, since we have a couple of seconds, I always want to encourage our listeners. We are a social media movement about creating communities of people who care about the planet. Check me out on Facebook, Twitter, sign up for my newsletter, look at the show schedule so you can be a part of thinking. Please stay here with me. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Castle Rock Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. The 2013 VW Jetta TDI is the sedan people love to love. It comes with a zippy turbocharged diesel engine that's 90% cleaner burning than previous diesel engines, and it goes farther on a tank of gas than a Toyota Prius. Chapman Volkswagen has a great selection of Jetta TDIs, so choose yours today at ChapmanTucson.com or in person at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson.
Can academic research really save the planet? This year, the University of Arizona took full ownership of Biosphere 2. With five ecosystems enclosed in over 7 million cubic feet of sealed glass, Biosphere 2 is a premier facility for environmental research, where the top minds in the world will come together to address some of humanity's greatest challenges, such as climate change. Now that's using your brains. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Habitat for Humanity's Havistar is changing the world. By selling new and used building and home improvement materials to the public, the Havistar is diverting more than 250 tons from the landfill each year. To donate, call 520-889-7200. Stop by and shop today. The Havistar is located at 935 West Grant Road. Proceeds from all the sales go to Habitat for Humanity Tucson. For more information, go to HabitatTucson.org or call 520-889-7200.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and we're certainly providing you with a great opportunity to think about a lot of things today. I am very excited about interviewing Dr. Joaquin Rees from the University of Arizona. He's the Vice President of Innovation and Strategy, the Executive Dean, College of Letters, Arts, and Science, the Dean of the College of Science, and a Professor of Geosciences. And we're not even going to get to all of those topics on an hour show, so time is flying. One more thing about the lecture series. You talk about the one of the byproducts was the integration and the lasting relationships of partnerships. Mm-hmm. How has it been in terms of there are actually people that don't go onto the campus? Mm-hmm. Has it been a really like a ripple effect in terms of having people come? Because, Joaquin, there are lots of things at the university that are not sellouts. Mm-hmm. People don't go. They're not, you know, there's it's not the same juice mm-hmm. as a lecture series has achieved. So how do you build on that, and how do you pick the topics? So mm-hmm. that's only two questions. I mean, has it helped with the public integration into the university in ways other than sports? And how do you pick the topics?
Okay, well, the first one is, yes, It's been very exciting, not only the fact that we fill Centennial Hall for each one of these lectures, and when you fill, when you have 2,000 people coming to hear about black holes, you know, you've sort of hit something.
It's a sweet spot.
I know.
It's really a sweet spot.
But more than that happens now, because there are communities that take the podcast and they recreate the lecture series at some other time in their own community, so the Pima Canyon Association or whatever. And they call me and they say, we're going to do this this year. And what I offer them is that a faculty member will go so that he or she can answer questions after the podcast. So that's number one. The topics are challenging. And there's a small little committee that I have. It's about five of us that have been doing this since day one. And we work really hard at trying to figure out what the topic should be. It has to be a topic, as I mentioned before, that's full of mystery, that is important, that is timely, and you can imagine that there are lots of them. So, for example, we don't want to use we don't come up with a topic as important as it may be, the water issues in the Southwest,
right.
Because it's not full of mystery. And unfortunately,
it's drying up.
Unfortunately, it's an issue that has to be addressed. We know what it is. It's an engineering issue at the moment, or maybe more than that. But it's not the same as arguing if there's a tipping point for global climate change.
Right.
All right. So we come up with that. But then the beauty is when the topic is chosen, then we actually go on the phone book, as it were, almost, and we choose the speakers out of the community, the university community. We invite them to my office. We ask them if they're interested. And if they're interested, they're the ones that organize that particular lecture series.
Awesome.
And what I would love to be able to do, and I'm trying to figure out how, is the most extraordinary conversations I've ever heard are when these faculty members are within themselves trying to, because they're from different disciplines.
Right. And it's in the creation stage.
Trying to put together the lecture series and the important topics. So last year was about the genome.
Right.
And the conversations were extraordinary. The year before that was living beyond 100. So I had folks that were interested in aging population and computer scientists, and how they were actually trying to come up with terms about how to deal with a lecture series that dealt with how are we going to be healthy as we approach 100 years old. Cool.
It's the creational stage. It's like the hidden camera.
Yeah.
And some of the times when we have team meetings and we're talking about it and everything's so passionate, we're like, we wish we had that on film.
Yep.
Just the development of the idea stage is really exciting. And that is not a bad idea to have some like videographer that you kind of have invisible, and then getting those out in terms of broadcasts. So let's talk about, because time's going to fly and we're never going to get to everything. I have two more pages, but you said something about the very interesting path that the biosphere has taken.
Right.
And when I go out there, I do get excited. And if I take my grandchildren, they do get excited. It's thinking about going to the biosphere and having that huge, unbelievable structure that created global attention,
right,
and bringing life back into it. I know Rafe Sagarin is going over there. He wanted to. He's excited. He wants to work on the ocean part of it, you know, grow up in tide pools. So in terms of your challenges, and you said it's something I worry about, what's it going to take? I mean, we've got Phoenix, we've got Tucson, we've got all these people. We have populations to make it work. What are you working on?
Okay. If you let me digress for a second, just to remind the folks that listen about the history of the biosphere, just a few minutes. The Biosphere was a brainchild of Mr. Ed Bass from Texas, who was interested in creating, in acquiring the intellectual property needed to colonize the moon. In those days, even now, we know that if we want to send people to Mars, for example, we really can't do it from the Earth because of the shielding required, the weight of the, payload, right? So you need to send the rockets from somewhere that has less of a gravitational field, and the moon is perfect, so that you would go from here to the moon. That would be your Texaco station, and from the moon you'd take off wherever else in the solar system. The scale of the thing is 3.14 acres under glass. And the idea when it was created was that you would have, an entity that would not require any transfer of mass in or out.
Like a sealed envelope.
It was a sealed envelope. The only thing you would transfer in and out was energy. So you'd have an air, whatever. And there, that was a huge challenge. And they recognized that since day one, that it was a challenge for it to actually generate the right atmosphere, because that was the trick. They didn't want to actually have to pump in gases
or
scrub gases. They wanted to make sure that it would be working just like the Earth. And the reason the name is Biosphere 2 is because the Earth is Biosphere 1.
Right.
And what happened was that because the biosphere, of course, is under glass, the glass won't let any of the UV radiation in. And the worry was that they wouldn't have the right compounds of nitrogen that would help grow plants.
Right.
And their solution to that was putting in soil that was very, very rich. And that was the problem, because the minute that they closed the doors to the biosphere, the soil sucked up all the oxygen. So these people were living at 16,000 feet elevation. And the concrete, which was not cured because they didn't want it to they thought about it hard. They didn't want the concrete degassing into the biosphere because they didn't know what that would do to things, started sucking up the CO2 because that's what it does. So anyway, these folks couldn't grow anything. They couldn't breathe very well, and it was a mess. When that experiment failed, and it was, as a scientist, it's cool, right? Because if you have a failed experiment, you've learned something.
That's right. It's the whole point.
Yeah.
If we're going to take this to the moon, we better figure things out here on Earth, not a failure.
Right. So a failed experiment is how we learn. Experiments that don't fail, that means we knew the answer already, and we just are getting the stamp of approval through the experiment. So then Columbia came in because it was a geochemist at Columbia by the name of Wally Broker that figured out the atmospheric composition, what was going on with the atmosphere. And Columbia very successfully ran the biosphere for many years. They had an Earth semester for their students. In fact, most of the policy wonks that are out there that deal with global climate stuff had their start at the biosphere, taking this thing called the Earth semester, which is a combination of policy and science. It was really well done. But Columbia changed presidents, and the logistics, actually, of having something 5,000 miles away is not trivial.
Right.
So they decided that that was the end of it. But they had papers that dealt with, they were the first ones that wrote credible papers that showed that as CO2 went up in the atmosphere, the oceans would acidify and the corals would die. That was done at the biosphere.
And look what's happening.
It's exactly what's happening.
Look what's happening. Ocean the acidification.
And the coral death.
Yes.
They also did some very interesting experiments on physiology of plants, and they showed that plants, sooner or later, I mean, one would think that if you have a lot of CO2, the plants would be as happy as clams, but sooner or later, they get stressed. There's too much CO2, too much of a good thing, and they change their metabolism, so that's not a infinite reservoir for any CO2. So they did great work. In fact, they pointed out that when CO2 gets too high, plants start emitting greenhouse gases. So that was a brand new thing that they didn't know. Anyway, when Columbia left, we were lucky that the owners came to us to say we were interested in it. And of course, I was completely excited about it, because what the biosphere gives you, for regardless of what experiment you're doing, it's scale. And if you look at all the ecological experiments that are done today, as well as any experiment in science, scaling is a big deal. But in ecology, there are two sorts of end-member ecologists, those that work in the lab with very elegant sort of flower pots where they can measure everything, and then those that are in the field, where they can see the real ecology and they can't really measure everything very well and there's no control in the experiments. And sometimes the observations of these folks is like two different planets. So having something in the middle of the scale, and that's what the biosphere gives you, it's big enough that you can scale these experiments, is exciting. So at the moment, what we're doing, we have two significant and very large experiments going on. The first one is we built these big slopes. It's called the Landscape Evolution Observatory. Right. And the whole idea simply is that what's going to happen, it's the mass balance of water in semi-arid environments as global climate change progresses. So to put it bluntly, if you look at Arizona as an example, and as global climate change progresses, we're probably going to lose our winter rain. It's going to go away. And the monsoon, we don't know. It may rain more or less, or it may rain more, but in big bursts,
it's
complicated. But even if it rains more in the monsoons, but we lose a winter rain, our ecology is going to change, right? Because our ecology requires not only the certain amount of rain, but it requires a certain periodicity of rain.
Right, right.
And if that changes, right now, atmospheric scientists believe that in a region like ours, about maybe 20% of the humidity in the atmosphere is because of evapotranspiration of plants, which then drives weather. So as the plants change, the humidity in the air is going to change, the amount of water going into rivers is going to change, all of that. Where water ends up
and
changes.
And it is. I mean, it is changing.
Right.
We just went to Madera Canyon, and for the first time in 9 years, there's no water running, and it just there's 9 inches last year, 1 inch this year.
Right.
So there's adaptation going on already that we have no control over.
Right. So we're trying to figure out all of that up front. And it's very exciting because it's an experiment that was created in the interface of geology, ecology, hydrology, and atmospheric sciences, dealing with a grand challenge of science. It's this business that the big grand challenges in science right now are at the edges of disciplines. And this is a great example of how we can actually address them.
That's a living lab out there.
That's
that
right.
You can, like you said, like scale. It's right there, sitting there, already constructed.
The other experiment that we're doing, which is very important, is we have a rainforest at the biosphere. And we're stressing it out to see how much stress a rainforest can take before it dies. We're not going to kill it, but we're going to stress it enough that we can understand by the chemistry when it's really stressed. Because we don't really know how much stress, for example, the Amazon is going to take before it dies. And that's going to be a hugely significant event. And that's the kind of stuff we're doing there.
For the rest of our lives and forever to come.
Right.
But when you... Oh, no. I can't believe this. I shouldn't be saying this on the air. We just got the two-minute warning, which means there's not nearly enough time. We didn't get to talk about the excitement that you're working on with Michael Tompkins. He's going to be on the show in a couple of weeks.
Great.
In studio. So maybe I'll just ask him to cover that topic.
Do that.
So we can
do
say,
that.
What's up with Miraval and Joaquin, and what are you cooking up? And if our friend Jim Gentile is going to have his finger in that, I miss him. So... in terms of the takeaway for people, one of the things you did, we're not going to have time, is when you had the whole response to the tsunami, and there was a great deal of fear out there, mm-hmm. and you put together a lecture series, a one-night thing, to just assuage people's fear, another one that was full. Mm-hmm. I mean, people just said, we got to know. Okay, I'm sorry, people. I know that you want to think more like I am and hear more from Joaquin. Maybe someday he'll fit in his schedule to come back. Next week, this is our Focus on the Future series with the University of Arizona. Don Falk, Associate Professor, School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona, and we'll be talking about forest fires, quite a topical issue, and lots of America is burning as we speak. Thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. Make it a great green week, and Joaquin, thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
It's been a real pleasure. I hope you have me again.
I will. Talk to Frankie.